You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations all across the United States, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and several hundred cable systems nationwide via the Free Speech TV Network. More people watch or listen to this program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. Welcome to our home. And today is Occupy Day. Today is May Day. May Day all the way back to the Haymarket Square, some would call them riots, and events. And the four martyrs who were killed in Haymarket Square on May 3rd, as I recall, 1887, and it has become an international day, May Day, May 1st. And one of the people who really knows this stuff well is Leo Gerard, the president of the United Steelworkers Union, USW.org, of course, the website. President Gerard, welcome back to the program.
Pleasure to be on with you, Tom.
It's an honor to have you, sir. This brilliant piece over at Alternet that you posted, Killing Democracy, One Vote at a Time, can you riff about this a little bit, and also about your thoughts on this being May Day and the Occupy movement and everything else that's happening here?
Sure. Let me say that Killing Democracy, One Vote at a Time is meant to raise a whole bunch of issues, in particular the voter suppression issue that is literally just astounding that this could go on in a country that attempts to promote itself worldwide as the world's leading democracy. I've said a number of times that I'm privileged to have the job I have. I'm privileged to interact with the labor movement all around the world. And there is no other advanced democracy on the planet where a so-called legitimate political party is working hard to make it harder for people to vote. And so there's that level. There's the attack on women and women's rights, trying to roll back the clock to the 1950s in some cases. The attack on collective bargaining, where in particular in Wisconsin, which was the first state to have collective bargaining for public sector workers, attempting to roll that back. The income inequality that's generated in the country. You can't have a democracy that pretends to lift all boats when you got these systematic attacks on quote, the 99%, which brings me to the Occupy movement. The Occupy movement, I think, worldwide, not just in America and in Canada, but worldwide, focused on the global benefits to the already rich and already powerful. And I've said this, and our union has said this for a long time. The economic agenda that's been put together is one that rewards rich countries at the expense of poor countries, rewards rich people in poor countries at the expense of poor people in poor countries, rewards rich people in rich countries at the expense of every person that's not rich in advanced countries. So these are all the issues that I tried to sort of, and not just in this last blog about attacking democracy one vote at a time, but in the blogs we've been doing.
Yeah, and you did so brilliantly. I'm curious your thoughts on the role of unions in the movement to take back. In fact, actually, let me rephrase that. Back a couple of years ago, there was this, you know, card check, right? The Employee Free Choice Act.
Right.
It died. I'm astounded by this. My understanding is that pretty much every other democracy in the world has some analog to it. We don't. How do we get through to our politicians that this should be a right, not a privilege, to have a democracy in the workplace to organize?
Well, you know that to pretend it's not going to be a heavy lift and an ongoing challenge is it'd be ludicrous. But let me just say this. For those that profess to be pro-democracy and pro-freedom and pro-all that stuff from the right and the extreme right, I've challenged them now for the last 10 years that I've been president of Steelworkers. Show me an advanced democracy that doesn't have a strong, free, independent labor movement. When there's a totalitarian regime of the left or the right, the group that comes out together to help overthrow those totalitarian regimes are usually trade unionists and students.
There was the movement against Mussolini, and it was also the Lech Walesa, the movement against the Soviet Union.
If you go to Brazil, Lula da Silva was the head of the metal workers union. They put him in jail. When he came out, he formed the Labor Party, and it was the Labor Party with students, or the Workers' Party, they called it,
yep.
Workers' Party with students, and they took him to victory, and he became the president of Brazil.
Right.
So there's that issue that's out there. But look at the other thing that we've written about in our blogs is the money in the American political system is like a cancer on the body. It's being consumed. We see the kind of disgusting, miserable ads. Who would want to throw themselves into that political environment where they'll attack you for what you did when you're in grade school with private money from sources you don't know? And for them to pretend that there isn't foreign money in that electoral process is just nuts. So if we're going to get the Employee Free Choice Act, we're going to do it by mobilizing ordinary folks to take control of the political process. We're going to have to mobilize ordinary folks, poor folks, immigrants, all of those that are part of the 99%, which Occupy movement helped to highlight. We're going to have to take over the ballot box. We're going to have to vote, 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 and put people in there that really care about democracy by the people for the people, not democracy by the rich for the rich.
Yeah, and step by step doing this, bringing back a strong labor movement in the United States in the face of a 30-year sustained assault since Ronald Reagan came to office, yep. and one of his very first acts was to destroy a union that he had actually, said he was going to protect. He had an agreement with PATCO, and he, of course, lied to them. How else to say it?
Well, being lied to by Republicans is not something that he invented, but he did it well, and it's been enhanced a lot. I was watching some stuff on television last night with my wife, and we saw Mitt Romney actually say the president wants to divide America. He wants to take things from the poor. I want to give things back to the poor. Give me a break. I mean, the guy's lying through his teeth. And doesn't give a darn.
Yeah.
So that isn't something new. But I think, Tom, shows like yours and the other progressives, the labor movement, the anti-poverty movement, the housing movement, I mean, all of us that are out there struggling, we should understand that we can't win alone. The only way we're going to do things is by bringing all the different disparate groups of the 99% together. I was at the dentist the other day just to divert. And I had on the 99% and proud on my jacket.
Uh-huh.
And the dentist says, "What's that about?" And I explained it to him, and I said, "You're probably in the 1%." And he said, "Hell no!" He said, "I'm in the 99%, and I need to get with you guys."
There you go.
So here's a dentist that the system is screwing him too.
Yeah. Well, the 1%. I think it's $365,000 bucks or something like that, and above annual income throws you into the 1%. But
he might have been 364. He was ideologically with us, right?
There you go. There you go. And you guys are doing such great work with the Steelworkers Union, and hopefully we can see more of a coming together of idealistic young people who are out in the streets and the people who have been on the front lines for generations now in the union movement and to this discussion of who's co-opting whom and all this kind of stuff, and let's just all work together.
Well, all we had to do, Tom, is look around the world over the last 50 years. Anytime there's been what I call ideological change for the good, it's been brought about by workers and students, and that's who we need to hook together
workers
and bring everybody else in.
You got it. Leo Girard, the president of the United Steelworkers Union, USW.org. Thank you, President
Girard. You're welcome. And by the way, Tom, look at what happens with students in Quebec who are in the streets for 11 days refusing to go to university because they're jacking up student fees. And they said it's not about the fees, it's about punishing us while you reward the elites.
We'll check it out.
This is the Tom Hartman Thank you, sir. Program.
We'll be right back with more from the Occupy movement. Oh, Jackson Brown's going to be with us in our third hour. This portion of our program is brought to you by the new book, Where Did the Towers Go? By Dr. Judy Wood, a materials scientist and structural engineer. Go to wheredidthetowersgo.com for more information. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. And just a quick preview of our day. Al Mixon is going to be with us in just a moment, the International Vice President of the Internet of the Brotherhood of Teamsters in Ohio. Mike Andrews is going to be with us with Occupy Wall Street at, these are Eastern time. Coming up, Saria Jaramana, the co-founder and national director of the Restaurant Opportunities Center. Joshua Holland with Alternet is going to be on the line. Ben Zucker with Occupy. Mark Taylor Canfield. David Graeber is going to drop by. Jackson Brown will be with us. And Axel Caballero in our third hour are going to be with us. So it's going to be a busy day of Occupy the World. Today is May Day. It's International Labor Day, celebrated in 80 nations. Not the United States so much, but 80 nations and actions all over the country, all over the world. Al Mixon with the Teamsters, www.teamster.org, the international VP of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Al, welcome.
Hey, how you doing today?
I'm great. I hope all is well with you.
Well, we're trying to get there. Today is a great day with a lot of parades and speeches and rallies around the country.
And tell me, first of all, I'm curious, the last time we talked with I'm not sure it was with you, Al, but it was one of the folks in the Teamsters. It might have been James Hoffa. It was about this whole thing with what's going on with the Red Cross workers. What's that situation like right now?
Well, I tell you, in all honesty, Tom, it hasn't gotten much better.
Really?
We actually had mediation this past Tuesday, and we modified our proposals at a level that should make some sense to this employer, and they continue to basically just say no. In all honesty, on our end, in Cleveland, we've been out on strike since February the 14th, and just for the record, I've taken three different strike votes because we're going on 3 months now, mm-hmm. and the people continue to vote unanimously to stay out. Even though we know that they're holding the economic decline, that they're not having to check and everything else.
Right.
But the justice is so superior regarding what this employer is doing, the people just said enough is enough.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, Tom, we've had Lansing, Michigan, the OPEIU has joined us because they're going through the same struggle. They've been without a contract for about 5 years, in all honesty. You had a Teamsters local out there in Lansing as well that's been without a contract for 3 years as Teamsters Local 580. And we're on our way to Toledo now. We're going to have our big May Day rally. And the UFCW, Red Cross Workers, has been on strike now for 3 weeks where collectively we're hoping we can make an impact. It's just really they're not bargaining in good faith at all. They're doing surface bargaining. And if you will, I had something of a unique document that kind of fell in my lap regarding the blueprint of them really never intending to negotiate in good faith.
Yeah.
So we're looking to file some unfair labor practice charges and do some things that hopefully we can just end up, more importantly, get these workers back to work. They want to get back to work, but they want to do the job that they're skilled to do without making mistakes because they're understaffed and they overpresent. They don't get lunch. They don't get breaks. And then this health care proposal they have is so devastating, they can't even afford to go to the hospital themselves, as much as we like to make sure we take care of the patients in the hospitals collectively and doing our due diligence from that perspective. I mean,
yeah, it's amazing. The Red Cross has to be thinking that everybody loves the Red Cross. How could they? But this is really casting a light on some dark practices at this large and very profitable nonprofit, which is an interesting oxymoron.
No doubt. Really, when we did the research for a nonprofit, they actually, their bottom line is on an average of $2 billion a year regarding the CEOs that make well over $1 million and just continue to do things that's just really based on their whole mission statement, doesn't fit the Clara Barton that started this great Red Cross organization for the purpose of saving communities and lives.
Wow.
And they just continue to be a non-profit for profit, if you will.
Yeah.
In all honesty, Tom, they also have about $40 million that they've been paying for fines for just not following procedures. And what they like to do is point the fingers at the phlebotomists, the people that do the work,
that's really doing the best they can, but they're under so much pressure from the management. It's like process, process, process. Right. And they continue to process where they miss a procedure, and unfortunately, that affects the possibility of donor safety.
Yeah, and
the possibility of the problem, yes.
And the donors, I mean, and which is something, frankly, we all should be doing. I mean, it's actually healthy for, particularly for men, to give blood at least twice a year. But the donors are they think that they're donating. They don't realize, A, that this blood is going to be sold at a fairly high price, and B, that the CEOs are making hundreds of the senior officers are making hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars at the Red Cross, and they're trying to screw their workers.
Yeah, no, it's really, and that's the problem we're having, even though our message to the community is really taking a different turn, but it recognizing exactly the struggle that we're going through. And the other side of the coin, they're using supervisors. They have newer people in that they're trying to train, that the donors aren't getting the best experience. Mm-hmm. And again, our whole bottom line is that we're not trying to hurt the hospitals or the patients, but somewhere along the line, if someone doesn't speak truth to power or bring justice to this management team hiding behind this great emblem, I mean, it's just really a travesty. And to be honest with you, Tom, as well, they have a board of governors that has blockbuster mentality. The Walmart CEOs are sitting there. So they continue to drive more and more to end up undermining the people to the point of part-time and no benefits and piss them off enough, really, where they just eventually want to quit so they can increase their profit that much more.
Yeah, amazing. Al Mixon with the Teamsters, the International VP out of Ohio. Al, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
Keep up the great work. Teamster.org, the website. And it is 27 minutes past the hour. It's Occupy Day. Occupying the media here, Tom Hartman with you. We will be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Coming up, a live report from the streets of New York City. What's going on in that fair burg? Right after this.
With the 99.
34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, your media support group for We the People of the United States of America. And Mike Andrews will be with us hopefully shortly. He is out on the streets in New York City with the Occupy Wall Street group, OccupyWallStreet.org, and haven't been able to get through to him. So hopefully he's not, like, you know, being pepper sprayed or something. But if you are out in the streets anywhere in the United States, give us a shout. And 866-987-THOM is our telephone number. And we'd like to know what's going on with you and where you are. Harry in Providence, Rhode Island. Hey, Harry, what's on your mind today?
Tom, great to talk with you again. I have some exciting Occupy news. OccupyLabor.org was launched today.
Mm-hmm.
And it has some great articles on it, including the Fed bailout of fat cats, $29 trillion, which a lot of people haven't heard about. It also
is
has,
this a site that is attacking labor or supporting labor?
Oh, absolutely not. No, this is an Occupy site.
Okay.
Because
one never knows these days. I mean, the Koch brothers are so, and others like them, are so good at coming up with front groups that have such nice-sounding names, you know.
They are. Well, another one is my hope is that this could expand the Occupy movement. I have an article here charting 30 years of class warfare.
Yeah.
And the charts, about four or five of them, very concisely show that the people who receive any kind of a paycheck rather than dividends and investments, they are part of the 99%. There are a lot of other articles and great features from
Harry, you got a great plug out there for it, OccupyLabor.org, and you know, good luck. I wish you the very best with it. John in Tucson. Hey, John, what's up?
Oh, wow, I got on. That's great. Love what you're doing.
Thank you. What's on your mind?
What was on my mind, you know, I'm not really educated or anything, but I was wondering about the 99% thing and if it like, who best represents the 99%, or is that the whole point, that nobody's really representing the 99%?
I think the point is that there are very few people who are representing the 99%. I think there are a few elected officials, Bernie Sanders, Sherrod Brown, Jan Schakowsky. There's a few good people in Congress, and unfortunately, it's a very few. I think there's about 80 members of the Progressive Caucus in Congress, and you get people, crazies, right-wing Republican crazies like Alan West, calling them communists. And then there's the labor movement, which was a third of all workers in the United States until Ronald Reagan came along. Now it's about 8% in the private workforce, about 11% nationally. So, you know, we've got some work to do here. And the 99% rising up and saying, hey, we're here and we don't like the fact that the Supreme Court has basically turned our democracy, our country, over to the fat cats. And thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Jerry in Chicago. Hey, Jerry, thanks for listening to Chicago's Progressive Talk, WCPT. What's up?
Oh, thank you. Great show. I was listening the other day to Chris Hayes, his program Up with Chris Hayes.
Yeah.
He did an interview with the co-author of a book called How Nations Fail.
Yes.
I can't remember the name of the co-author, but the book was essentially about the failure of political processes, especially here in the United States, because the political elite find it is not in their economic interest to do so.
That's right. And in fact, this book was, I'm pretty sure it was one of my BuzzFlash books of the month a year or year and a half ago. You can probably find it over at BuzzFlash.com. I've read the book, and it's a very well-done analysis of how economic elites decide that the political system isn't working to their benefit, and so they basically seize control of it, and then ultimately it destroys the political system, and it devolves either into chaos, into fascism, or into, you know, something else.
Yeah, he made the point, I thought, very succinctly, that the reason these economic problems are not solved is not because they don't know how to solve them, but because they deliberately won't.
Yeah, not only deliberately won't, they deliberately work in opposition to them, because solving those social problems, solving, you know, doing the things that society is organized to do. Why do humans get together? Why did we form tribes back in the day, in the very earliest times, clans? But, you know, we do it for mutual protection. That's what society, social, where the word comes from. The whole idea of a we society. But these predators, basically, they view society as something to be preyed upon, and, you know, to pick the meat off the bones, and now they're starting to crack the bones and suck out the marrow. I mean, it's terrible. Jerry, thank you for the call. Very well said. Dave in Murphy's, California. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'd like to say that I studied economics, and the basis of economics is growth. Without growth, capitalism does not work. So if capitalism needs growth to survive, austerity is the tightening of the belt, but the Republican platform seems to be tourniquet on the belt.
Yeah.
And if we struggle, if we tighten the tourniquet and we have no growth, what's going to replace capitalism?
Well, it depends on how you define growth. And there's there are a variety of forms of growth. And there is, you know, sustainable capitalism, where basically one system, one part of the system that is anachronistic, that's no longer needed or isn't doing well, slowly dies off and is replaced by something new. So it doesn't necessarily require growth, but there are some very, very good alternatives to capitalism. And the main one is cooperativism. And if that's the word, maybe I just made up the word, but cooperative, like Mondragon, where the workers actually own the business. Go ahead.
Or how about green capitalism?
What does that mean?
Green capitalism is sustained growth.
Oh, yeah, sustainable growth, sure.
Where we don't throw things out.
Yeah, and here's the thing that people don't – well said, Dave. Thank you very much. And here's the thing that people don't get is that capitalism comes about because we, the people, decided to allow it. Right? I mean, think about that for a minute. We got together. We said we don't like the way the British are doing things. Threw the tea in the harbor, had a Revolutionary War, all that kind of stuff. And then we decided that we would establish laws that gave specific privileges and rights to people if they did business. And in exchange for those privileges and rights, what we would like from them is some sort of social good. And that was the predominant notion from the founding of this country up until the election of Ronald Reagan. And over the last 30 years, it's been turned on its head. Well, it's happened before, actually. It happened during the Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover administrations as well. It's like every 80 years, we have these moments of insanity that last a couple of administrations where we think that the purpose of society is to provide fodder for the predators, rather than, you know, that society provides the opportunity for people to generate wealth for themselves in exchange for producing something good for society, if that makes any sense. Well, actually, I think it does. Sasha in Monroe, Washington. Hey, Sasha, thanks for listening to Talk 1090. What's up?
Yeah, you just one of your callers just mentioned Koch brothers tricks, and I think I have one. I have a sneaky suspicion I just joined one. On 1090 AM here, we have a advertisement that goes out saying there's a $300 gas rebate by Prestige Rebates, and I just joined it and sent my stuff in into them, and it's got all kinds of tricks you have to jump through
okay.
to get a little
Sasha,
bit.
Sasha, I'm sorry to cut you off there, but I don't know anything about an individual advertiser on one of our stations. I've not heard the ads, and I you know, it might be a great organization, it might not. I just it would be unfair for me on the national show here to be commenting on this. Chris in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I've been listening to your show, and it's refreshing to hear some other points of view other than just the mainstream media. However,
but,
I live in Phoenix.
Excuse
question
me.
For you. Do you think it's wrong if in Arizona that I have to move my kids out of a school because that school has become, unfortunately, went from a high rating to a low rating? This is an elementary school, but the principal herself said that the reasoning was that the scores had dropped was because they had a large number of ELL students. Well, I looked that up later, which meant English language learning, and found that we do have a lot of illegal residents in. You know, right or wrong, poverty, I don't think it fixes it by, you know, I don't know the answers, but I do know for me as a white person, I feel like you're making me want to feel guilty for that and teach my children to feel bad about who they are.
Well, you know, when there was a huge wave of Italian immigrants into the United States in the 1880s and 1890s, there was this...
Then.
Well, you know, there was this huge pushback against it because most of them were coming into New York City, and the New York City school systems, New York schools, and not just schools, society. I mean, these people didn't speak English, right?
Right.
The same thing in Michigan and Wisconsin. My grandparents came to the United States; they spoke Norwegian on my father's side, and there's a huge Norwegian community in northern Michigan, a huge Swedish community, in Minnesota and Wisconsin.
I know, that's why I say you're speaking to the...
And what those people, and what the people who were already here were saying was, what are these people doing here? They don't speak our language, they're dragging down our standards of education, they're making things awful. You know, within a generation, it heals itself. What I would say to you is, I'm not going to lay a guilt trip on you, but what I would say to you is, if these kids stay here and become productive citizens of the United States, it's all to our benefit. This is the history of America, that we're a nation of immigrants. Your ancestors, unless you're Native American, came here at some point. And what we need to do with regard to our schools failing as a consequence of that kind of a load is fund our schools better. You know, let's provide more resources to the schools so that they can meet the needs of all of our kids. Chris, thank you for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's Occupy the World Day, May Day, here on the Tom Hartman Program. Back with more of the Occupy Movement after this. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And Saru Jayaraman is with us. Saru is the co-founder and national director of the Restaurant Opportunities Center United, ROC United. ROCUnited.org is the website. Welcome to the program, Saru.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the Restaurant Opportunities Centers United.
Sure. We founded the organization just after 9/11 with the workers who lost their jobs at Windows on the World, which was the restaurant at the top of Tower 1 of the World Trade Center. 73 workers died that day. And about 300 workers lost their jobs. We built the organization in the aftermath of tragedy to help restaurant workers get back on their feet. But we were pretty soon thereafter flooded with calls for help from restaurant workers, first all over New York City and then all over the country, because the restaurant industry right now is the largest and fastest growing sector of the U.S. economy. It's over 10 million workers nationwide.
Wow.
The industry actually claims that by the end of the year, 1 in 10 Americans will work in restaurants. And yet, it's the employer of 7 of the 10 lowest paid occupations in America and the absolute 2 lowest paid jobs in America, lower than farm workers and all other workers. So you've got this huge, very profitable, growing industry that's providing the lowest paid jobs in America. And as a result, we've had to grow really rapidly to meet the demand. We're now 9,000 workers in 19 cities. We do campaigns against exploitation in large high-profile restaurants. We partner actually with really good restaurants that are doing the right thing, providing good wages and good working conditions. We've opened our own worker-owned restaurants, cooperative restaurants in New York and Detroit called Colors. We've trained thousands of workers a year in livable wage job skills and helped them get into good jobs in the industry. And we do a lot of research and policy work. So we've been fighting, for example, to raise the minimum wage for tipped workers at the federal level from $2.13, which it's been stuck at for the last 21 years, to at least $5. So that's a quick snapshot of who we are. But we're in 19 cities now around the country and fighting to improve wages and working conditions for restaurant workers all over the country.
That's extraordinary. That is an absolutely extraordinary success story. And today is May Day. Today is the Occupy the World Day. What is the Restaurant Opportunities Centers United? What are you up to today?
Well, every year on May Day, we join the marches and rallies around the country that are all about both immigrant workers' rights and the right to organize and the right to fair and decent working conditions for all people in the United States and everywhere. But this year is actually particularly significant for us because we've got a campaign against the world's largest full-service restaurant company at the moment. It's the Darden Restaurant Corporation. They own Olive Garden, Red Lobster, Capital Grille Steakhouse, Longhorn Steakhouse. And they are, incredibly well-financed, very, a corporation that's doing really well that does not provide paid sick days to any of its employees, meaning that workers work while sick, and pays its workers as little as $2.13, even though the head of the company is making $8.5 million in profits every year or in his income every year.
Wow.
And so, this company, immigrant workers and African-American workers approached us saying that they had been denied access to promotions to the best jobs in the company, and we launched a campaign in 5 cities around the country against the company and against discrimination and exploitation in the company. And so this May Day, not only have we joined the rallies around the country, we've actually brought the rallies to the Capitol Grille Steakhouse in 5 cities, and we're doing a week of actions with a lot of the May Day folks on the Capitol Grille to kind of demand that this company, as an example of the kinds of companies that are exploiting immigrant workers and all workers around the country, change their practices.
That is brilliant. When I lived in Portland, Oregon, I don't recall if it was the city or the state, you may know, passed a law saying that restaurant workers, specifically waiters and waitresses, had to be paid a minimum wage. And the minimum wage in Oregon is about a dollar higher than the federal minimum wage, maybe a little more than that. Had to be paid minimum wage in addition to tips rather than the typical $2 an hour plus tips. My understanding is that it actually not only improved the quality of life of the people who were doing the work, but that it didn't produce the apocalypse that the owners of restaurants, the big restaurant corporations like you're talking about here with, the Olive Garden branch or group. Garden. Thank you. That they prophesied.
Right. That's exactly right. Oregon is actually one of 7 states in the country, including California and the state of Washington, that do not have a difference between the regular minimum wage and the minimum wage for tipped workers. And they're actually some of the most successful restaurant industry states in the country. California actually has the largest restaurant industry of the city with the largest restaurant industry of any city in the country, which is Los Angeles. It actually has a larger restaurant industry than New York. So no, they're doing great, and they don't allow this subsidy or exemption to the restaurant industry, which essentially is what this lower wage is. This subminimum wage is essentially forcing consumers to pay the wages of restaurant workers, meaning that the restaurant industry is the only industry getting this huge exemption from federal law, from the federal minimum wage. And that's actually what they're fighting for across the board. The restaurant industry the NRA, the National Restaurant Association, we like to call it the other NRA,
right.
You know, is a huge, powerful lobbying group in Congress and in different state legislatures fighting for exemptions for the restaurant industry from every law you can imagine. Right now they're arguing that restaurant workers are independent contractors so that they won't have to comply with health care reform if it goes through.
What? You know, yeah. I thought independent contractors could work wherever they wanted.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. That's
incredible. And presumably, so they don't have to provide them with health care. They don't.
Exactly. Well, yeah. Plus, they've tried to claim all kinds of other exemptions for their industry in particular, even though, like I said, they're predicting $630 billion in profits this year. And they're the only sectors to grow during the economic crisis rather than decline.
Amazing. Absolutely incredible. We heard from Leo Gerard in the first hour of the United Steelworkers Union about the state of labor. We heard from Al Mixon earlier, just before you called, from the Teamsters talking about the Red Cross. It's like every industry is trying to figure out a way to make more profits for their CEOs at the expense of their workers. Saru Jayaraman with ROCUnited.org is the website. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you, and Joshua Holland, the senior writer and editor at alternet.org, is out perambulating, walking around on the streets amongst the Occupy folks. What's going on, Joshua?
Hey, Tom. Yes, there's many, many protests across the Bay Area. It's actually very difficult to cover just because everything's so sprawled out. So I started this morning at a picket for the transportation workers in San Francisco. Then I ended up at an immigrants' rights march, also in San Francisco. Then I went out to Oakland, where there were at least four protests. It's been very, very peaceful wherever I've been. But as soon as I left Oakland, I've gotten reports from colleagues of mine who say that there was some tear gas deployed and some clashes between police and protesters.
There was a news story about this happening yesterday as well, was there not, or am I?
Yesterday there was a kind of pre-May Day. It was more of a social event than anything else. And what happened was, the details are kind of sketchy, but a group of about 20 or 30 people broke off from the main protest and went and broke windows at local cafes in the Mission District in San Francisco. It's an odd story. You know, I'm always very, very quick to dismiss claims that all of the trouble is being made by agents provocateur or you know, police plants or anything like that. However, this morning I spoke with three people who I've you know, interviewed before, all members of Occupy San Francisco. And they all said the same thing, which was that these people were not familiar to them and didn't look the part. So I don't really know what to make of it. I don't want to, you know, start a conspiracy theory, but it does seem like there's some discrepancies.
I mean, let's just do a little thought experiment here, Joshua. You know, sometimes they're useful, sometimes they're nutty, but if the Koch brothers, for example, or somebody like them, you know, one of the Wall Street billionaires, you know, one of these guys who literally makes $2 billion a year on Wall Street and pays, if it's a bad year, pays 15% income tax, right?
Right.
If the Democrats were to take the House, the Senate, and the White House, those guys would suddenly see their taxes go up. I mean, they would lose literally tens to hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Lose is maybe the wrong word. They would have to pay their fair share, but you get my point.
Yeah.
So investing, a I mean, what can you buy somebody who is willing to go out and smash some windows for? You know, $1,000, $5,000, $10,000 if it's really high risk work.
You know, this is obviously a speculative line of inquiry, but
extremely.
You know, they've hired the Pinkertons. Remember the Pinkertons?
That's my point. This is what they were doing in the 1880s.
You know, and so the word that I got from the three people that I interviewed was that these guys were very kind of athletic and they just didn't fit the part.
Yeah.
And while they were dressed in the right clothing, their clothing seemed new. I don't know what to make of it. Let's just say that this was something that did tarnish the May Day event.
Well, there's
whether it was intended to or not, it has had that effect.
Yeah, and I mean, if we go back in history, it was in 1887, was it not? Let me see here. On May 3rd, 80,000 workers. This was 1886. I'm sorry. 1886, when the Chicago police fired into a crowd of striking workers at the McCormick Reaper Works factory, killing four. The next day, there was a peaceful demonstration in Haymarket Square. Somebody threw a bomb. It killed a police officer. Now, that was 1886. There's still a debate, 140 years later, about whether the person who threw that bomb was a worker or a provocateur.
Right, and Canadian officials, more recent history, just a few years ago, actually admitted that they had provocateurs in a crowd, undercover provocateurs.
Yep.
It was a scandal. It was widely reported in Canada. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility. I'm always hesitant to make those assumptions simply because, you know,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I think we were going the same place, which is that there are some people within the movement who are advocating what they refer to as a diversity of tactics. When I was in SDS back in the day, there were people who wanted to go off and bomb buildings and things, and some of them did. It became the Weather Underground, and it really ultimately destroyed SDS. And I'm concerned that the diversity of tactics folks, in other words, let's smash some windows, are going to destroy the Occupy movement, and they'll do it without any help from the Koch brothers at all.
And assuming leaping to the conclusion that these are all plants or agents provocateurs, let those people off the hook. So
that's correct.
It's a good reason to be reticent when going down that avenue. But look, it's entirely possible. And from the details that I've gleaned this morning from Occupy San Francisco stalwarts, there's something to it. Remember, this is a relatively small community. I mean, I've just been reporting on these stories intermittently, and most of the faces are familiar to me at this point. So when someone says, here's this group of people, and we don't recognize any of them, that seems somewhat odd.
Right. Joshua, your thoughts on the Tea Party. The original Tea Party in 1773 was a group of local grassroots people who were protesting a massive tax cut given to the British East India Company so that they could basically Walmartize the North American continent, put all the small tea competitors out of business. And they were protesting this tax cut given by the British Parliament, almost all of whom were stockholders in the East India Company.
Right.
They were protesting the corruption of government and a tax, and corporate. The original Tea Party, I think a lot of people got duped into thinking that they were doing something like that, not realizing that, Dick Armey's a multimillionaire and he was paying for their buses and their sound stages and things. Are there folks showing up in these May Day events who 2 years ago might have thought that they were Tea Partiers, but now they're realizing that, hey, we got screwed?
Well, that's hard to say. I know that the Tea Party movement has declined in popularity. I think that these are people who share, if you look at the occupiers and other people who are involved in these May Day protests, these include a lot of union people, by the way. They have the same fundamental diagnosis of a system where government and big business have too cozy a relationship. But once you get into the prescriptions of how to address that, there's a mile-wide chasm between the Tea Partiers and more liberal people who are protesting today. And, I almost feel sorry for the Tea Partiers because they are, according to any number of studies, they are demographically relatively mainstream. In other words, a lot of them are part of the middle class, and they're unwittingly advancing policies that are really detrimental to their economic interests.
Yeah, they buy into this nonsense that if they watch Fox News, the bottom line, you know, that if Wall Street just took over Social Security, everything would be wonderful, you know.
That's right, and they need Social Security and they need Medicare, and they don't need to basically support politicians who only are looking out for the interests of the top 1%.
Yeah. So the May Day operations, the May Day activities in the San Francisco Bay Area are ongoing now.
Yes, they are. I'm taking a brief breather to recharge my cell phone and my camera.
Okay.
And
well, keep up the great work, Joshua, and keep us up to date. If anything happens, give us a shout, and we'll get you right on the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
It's great having your reporting. Joshua Holland of Alternet, alternet.org. And we will be right back. It's 15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Harbin Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Coming out next, Ben Zucker with Occupy DC, and then in our next hour, David Graeber and Jackson Brown with Occupy the Music. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, and Ben Zucker with OccupyWallStreet.org on the line with us, formerly with Occupy DC, now with Occupy Wall Street New York. Ben, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Great. Great to have you with us. I also want to bring on the line Roland Miller. Roland Miller is with the Occupy Wall Street PR Working Group at Occupy Wall Street. He's at a rally there. And if it's okay with you guys, we'll just bounce back and forth and have you fill us in. Roland, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. First of all, Ben, what's going on?
Well, things are really exciting. I was on a march today from Bryant Park to Union Square where we took the streets with thousands of folks, and the cops didn't want us there, but it was really empowering to see everybody around. And then now I'm over at Union Square where there's over 5,000 people, union members, people from the immigrant rights movement, and people from the Occupy movement. It's really exciting.
Now, this is in New York City?
Yes.
Okay. And Roland, are you in New York City as well?
I'm on the south side of Union Square. I'm overlooking the park. It's like 5,000 is right. It's really a beautiful sight. It's amazing.
That's great. So for all our listeners on WWRL or on Sirius XM or Dish or Direct who are in the New York City area, they could get down and you guys could probably wave at each other. Roland, what's going on there?
We have Tom Morello, who is the former guitar player for Rage Against the Machine. And we have a huge congregation of people. It's very festive. It's very celebratory. The sun is shining. So
that is super. Ben, what you started out with Occupy DC. Now you're with Occupy New York. What are the differences? What are the similarities? You know, just thoughts on the Occupy movement in general. You've been around for a while.
In D.C., you're right at the seat of government. So a lot of the protesting that you do is directly confronting that power. But here in New York and on Wall Street, you're really confronting the financial district. So I guess the focus is a little different in each of the different cities. But basically, the ideas are the same. You know, mutual aid, economic and social injustice. It's I'm excited to see May Day and so many folks out.
Yeah. Yeah, and Roland, the May Day events, to what extent are people branding this as May Day or talking about May Day as opposed to simply another Occupy event?
Well, this has been months in the making. We've reached out to a broad coalition of unions, all kinds of activists. So there really isn't much of a line between it being an Occupy event or a May Day event. The original people that called for this were the unions and Occupy.
Right.
But, that's not, looking on it now, it's not really a divide. It's more acceptable.
That's great to hear because I'm still getting, the occasional email and seeing the occasional article of, the unions are trying to co-op Occupy, or, oh, the Occupy is trying to exploit the unions, or blah-de-blah. And it seems like, we're all on the same side here. Ben, your thoughts on that?
You hear those whispers and conversations about co-option, but I really see a strong show of solidarity and unity out there today. Hopefully this is a step forward to these more established institutions and organizations working together with the social movement that's making a difference.
Yeah. And Ben, can you describe the kind of people who are in Union Square there in New York City right now? Ben? We just lost Ben. Roland, you want to take a shot at it?
Yeah, I think the signal was instant. It looks like lots of young people, lots of older people, really everyone with some new faces, and a lot of people we've been seeing for the better part of a year.
Uh-huh. That's marvelous. And you said older people as well. Do you think that you're seeing the maybe some of the people who might have thought they were Tea Partiers at some point, or is this the old anti-war generation showing up, or what?
You know, it's a real it's a mass gathering.
Uh-huh.
It looks like people that are on the left side of the state.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now your phone is breaking up, Roland. Ben is back with us. Ben Zucker. Ben, you were going to give us your sense of the crowd of the people who are there in New York and who is showing up and who is taking the day off work.
There are a lot of students who took the day off school and then a lot of folks who have been laid off because of the financial crisis who are out here today. I think it was a really great moment for everyone who's been ideologically feeling these thoughts all winter and hearing the message of the Occupy movement to come out in the spring. It's almost a spring awakening.
Yeah, it's a marvelous thing. Okay, Ben Zucker and Roland Miller. Gentlemen, thank you both for being with us today and for the great work that you're doing out there.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Thanks for calling in and being on the streets and sharing with us what you're seeing. John in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
I was wondering if it'd be possible for the 99% to form a corporation themselves, to govern themselves and to form with bylaws against hostile ownership, like via unlimited stock options with only one policy vote per stockholder to facilitate like contractual support of government candidates and maybe to prevent provocateurs and people like, well-minded people that get too excited and do the wrong thing, like laws like inciting a riot, in order.
I think the solution to the problem of people who think that smashing windows is a way to accomplish positive social goals is education, basically, is pointing out that there is no more powerful force on earth than nonviolence, than moral force. And when violence is met with nonviolence, I mean, I still think one of the iconic, in fact, the two iconic photographs, the two iconic moments from last year's Occupy movement activities were when the young women were kettled in New York City and pepper sprayed by officer, what's his name? And then again in Oakland, when a group of young people were simply sitting, legally on the sidewalk, and a police officer just casually walked along and pepper sprayed them in the face. And by not reacting with violence, by not playing the agent provocateur game, by not reacting with violence, they absolutely won that. I mean, they set such a powerful example.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And we have seen this over and over and over again throughout history. Up next, Mark Taylor Canfield with Occupy Seattle will be on the line. 27 minutes past that.
Welcome to the U.S. occupation. To win the hearts and minds, defend all humankind, tell the banks and the corporations, we're here to occupy the USA.
And if you're in the streets, if you're part of an occupation movement, if you're out there participating in today's May Day activities, give us a shout at 866-987-THOM. And if we can get you on between guests, we will absolutely do so. Mark Taylor Canfield on the line with us with OccupySeattle.org. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program. Or welcome
hey,
back.
Good to be with you today.
So happy May Day. What's going on?
Well, I've been trying to avoid tear gas. Unfortunately, things have gotten a little bit wild, and there was a march that left from Westlake Center at noon, and evidently there were some shenanigans along the way or something. The next thing I knew, our local self-appointed superhero named Phoenix Jones ended up pepper spraying a bunch of the demonstrators, and then I guess near the federal courthouse, the police used tear gas. So they're claiming that some folks from the march broke off and were doing something. I don't know. I actually wasn't there at that part of the march to see what happened, but there's definitely pepper spray and tear gas being used in Seattle. And since that happened, the march went back to Westlake Park, where all of our events are happening today. But I noticed that there's now a very large police presence,
which is
a difficult situation for us, because I had to go on a national or a public radio station earlier today to talk with a spokesman from the police department. And they have been the ones who have been talking up this issue of violence for about the last week. The mayor posted something on his website about it. And my response to that was, you know, the fact that you have been promoting this idea of violence, or at least spreading the rumor for a week, you know, is likely to encourage some people who maybe never had intended to participate in Occupy Seattle events to come down here and cause trouble. And this may be the result that we're seeing right now, Tom.
Right. People who have who do not share the goals of Occupy Seattle. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes. It was very clear in my discussion with a spokesperson for the police department that they understood that we had a permit to be in the park all day, that we had not endorsed any kind of violence, and that we wanted to have a peaceful day of hip-hop in the park. Tom, actually, some of the most talented hip-hop artists in Seattle are down here today. And also, ex-Black Panther member Aaron Dixon was down here speaking to the crowd, telling everyone that we really need to reach out to the community and build our numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was praising our food program, you know, because we have free meals now all around the city several times a week. But I'm just disappointed, you know, that the media may now decide to cover that little melee over any of the issues that we're out here for, which is workers' rights, immigration rights, and, you know, to support the Occupy Wall Street movement all over the country.
Yeah. Well, if it bleeds, it leads, you know. It's interesting. Joshua Holland and I were having a conversation at the top of the hour. He's, you know, the editor and writer at Alternet, and he's in the Bay Area, in the San Francisco Bay Area, and said that he spoke with, and he's a very, very competent journalist. Joshua, I have tremendous respect for him. And yesterday in Oakland, apparently, in San Francisco, there was a group of people, about 20 people or so, who peeled off from a main demonstration and went and smashed some windows. And his interviews with the people who were not the ones who smashed the windows, but were the ones who were the, you know, the main participants in the peaceful demonstration, what they were saying was that these people who went off and smashed the windows were wearing brand new clothes. They were, you know, they were dressed the part, but they were like freshly purchased, and they were like, you know, buff and athletic, and looked like they might have, you know, like Central Casting. Hey, send down some thugs, you know, that kind of thing. And we don't know if this was provocateurs or if it was just, you know, what it was. Nobody knows. I mean, but we do know that labor movements, all the way back to the time of the Civil War. I mean, you know, right after during and after the Civil War. In fact, Abraham Lincoln was the first president of the United States to use the word strike, and to endorse the rights of labor. And prior to the Lincoln administration, the word strike was always used in quotation marks in newspaper headlines and newspaper stories. And that from that period, you know, up until the 1930s, when the Wagner Act was passed, the National Labor Relations Act, and strikes were legalized and union activities were protected by the government, that it was not uncommon for when workers got together and were demanding their rights and were speaking out against the abuses of power by the wealthy and the powerful, for there to be agent provocateurs planted amongst them, you know, paid for by the fat cats. So who knows? On the other hand, there are also people who believe and passionately believe. I mean, there's some folks who were having quite a conversation about it in the chat room over at TomHartmann.com right now. About how any movement in history has always had a nonviolent movement has had a violent parallel to it. I would not agree that violent parallel helped that movement. I would say it set it back. In fact, the Haymarket bombing actually set back the labor movement, arguably by a decade. But Anyhow, your thoughts on that, Mark Taylor Canfield?
Well, I do know that most of the folks that were leading the parade this particular march were from the LGBT community, and because there is a part of our celebration today is freedom for the queer population. I mean, they really wanted to make a statement today about freedom, and everyone dressed in pink, and they're, you know, and they have clowns, and it's very festive. Well, those people were at the front of the march. Now, the people that, you know, ended up causing trouble were actually somewhere down towards the end of the march or the middle of the march. So all I know is that people started running in all directions, and there were pleas, you know, from the other activists, you know, just run. And I couldn't figure out why they were asking people to run, and then felt that there was tear gas that was being used up the street from Westlake Park, actually. Now the march has gone back to Westlake Park, although some people did scatter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's more of a police presence here, but it looks like things at Westlake Park, where we do have a permit and are planning this day-long hip-hop concert, it looks like things are very calm there.
Okay.
It's just that we're surrounded now by a lot of police pretty much on every street corner now.
That's great. Mark Taylor Canfield, OccupySeattle.org is the website with Occupy Seattle. Journalist and press liaison with Occupy Seattle. Mark, thanks for the report today.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for occupying the media and allowing us a voice. I really appreciate it.
It's my honor, Mark. Thanks a lot for dropping by. Joe in Toledo, Ohio. Joe, you're with Occupy Toledo?
Yes. We're having a small but intense protest here. We just heard a very rousing speech from Valdemar Velasquez, head of FLOC, and now we're marching over to join. There's a Red Cross worker strike going on just a few blocks away, so we're marching over there to join them.
Oh, that's marvelous. And so that would be the Teamsters. We had Al Nixon or Mixon on from the Teamsters, International Vice President of Teamsters, on early in the first hour of the program talking about the Red Cross strike. So, Joe, how did the day start there in Toledo, and how are things going right now?
Well, the day started with protests around. We have a local fella named Danny Brown who had some trouble with the legal trouble with Toledo, and so there was a protest there. And now, then we're at Levy Square, which is where the Occupy Toledo movement went on for several months until it was broken up by the police, and now. And now we have speakers today, and then we have speakers again tomorrow, and it's several days of activities. Yeah.
What do you think is going to come out of this, Joe?
Well, I think that what's coming out of it is that this community is coalescing here. I think with everything that happened, you know, we had an anti-nuclear protest not too long ago, and we've got people that are coming together on more and more issues and more people. I think it's
What's going on?
Bye.
What, Joe? Joe just had to go. Okay, that was interesting. Okay. So, James in St. Charles, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, James, what's up?
Well, you were talking a while back there about interactions with the Tea Party and the 99%. And a few years ago when the Tea Party was first coming to the fore, I was saying, you know, there are a lot of things that they are talking about that are actually things that I agree with. Yes, there are some things in government that are getting way out of hand. There are some things that still need to stay there. But some of the ways they were doing it, the rhetoric that was coming out was absolutely incendiary, and I was saying, I don't want anything to do with that. And so, what was it, a year ago, things started happening, and the 99% movement started developing, and there are a lot of things that I go for there. Yes, we do need to address the people's concerns, not just corporate concerns. And so, yes. There's a balance, but there are a couple of things that the 99% folks I don't agree with, but
for example,
more so than on the Tea Party side.
That statement fascinates me because the 99% movement, to the best of my knowledge, has not made any outrageous. Well, what do you disagree with them about?
Well, as far as outrageous, no. absolutely nothing outrageous. It's just some of the things that are being asked for, and
for example,
don't necessarily correspond with my thinking.
For example,
and
one example.
One of the challenges that I have, and this is me personally, is with the healthcare law and the individual mandate.
Okay, so you don't like Obamacare. The Occupy movement has not taken a position on Obamacare. In fact, I would suggest that probably most of them would say it doesn't go far enough. But in any case, thank you for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on around the United States, around the world. Then in the next hour, David Graeber and Jackson Brown are going to drop by, occupying the music.
Well, I was born on a Sunday. A Thursday, I had me a job.
Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Harbin here with you. Carolyn, listening on KABQ in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Carolyn, what's up?
Hey there. I'm a 60-year-old transplant to the beautiful land of New Mexico and was involved in Albuquerque on Unoccupy movement in Albuquerque, mm-hmm. and was arrested with some of the younger people on October 26th. And I feel like, number one, I wanted to show up. I didn't want them. I had been following the media and seeing that across the nation, citywide, there seemed to be a coordinated effort to get the kids out of the parks, get the people out of the parks.
Oh, yeah. There was very definitely nationwide. There was, you know, they got it. Hey, we've got to put a stop to this thing. And I think what they did is by squashing it, you know, winter came and people kind of, you know, it was cold out there anyway. And now I think it's going to come back with renewed force. Carolyn, thank you for the call. And thanks for listening to KABQ. Ellen Ratner's on the line with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.org. And Ellen, what's going on in the world?
Okay, well, basically, the president is halfway around the world. He left at around midnight last night. I actually got very suspicious when I saw the schedule today and saw that they weren't having a briefing till 3 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, something is going on. This is very unusual because there was nothing on the president's schedule today except supposedly a meeting with Leon Panetta, which obviously was a ruse. So he is in Kabul right now. As we speak, he is in the presidential palace. He will be addressing the American public tonight. We'll be getting in about a half hour what the actual address will be about. But we do know that he is planning on mentioning Osama bin Laden, and he is going to be signing with President Karzai this sort of strategic forces agreement that they have. In other words, what is it going to be on the way going forward?
Was May 1st the day on which bin Laden was killed?
I believe it was. I believe it was actually a year ago today.
Yeah, okay. So, therefore.
Or the last day, but it bled into today. I didn't mean that to sound like it did, but
no.
It did.
Yeah, no, I understand. No pun intended.
Right.
And today is May Day. There are Occupy movements all over the United States. We've been covering them. We've been getting reports from them.
I'm in New York, and there was a huge demonstration today down at Union Square, walking all the way downtown to Zuccotti Park. There were smaller things around the United Nations. I have to say, they must have gotten every off-duty cop in Manhattan today because the place is teeming with people. There was a demonstration in front of Fox this morning. It's been everywhere.
Wow, a demonstration in front of Fox. That's interesting. Now, the Wall Street banksters were talking, apparently some of their memos were leaked about how they were referring to the occupiers as wolves, which, you know, circling the sheep, that being the banksters, which I find particularly ironic given that the banksters are, you know, literally sucked $7 trillion worth of wealth out of the American middle class in 2008 and 2009. But nonetheless, apparently their fears were for naught. There's been demonstrations and things, but
yes, there
nothing
has
to be paranoid about.
I mean, honestly, and it was drizzling this morning, but of course now it's a beautiful day in New York. I haven't, other than a lot of traffic around those areas, which there certainly has been, it has not seemed to have a big effect. And don't forget, if you look at sort of the news cycle issue, so you have Occupy and May Day and all that on one hand, and then you have the president traveling to Afghanistan, and that seems to be, taking much of the Occupy air out.
Oh, that's interesting. Those two things are going to compete for all the oxygen in the room and in newsrooms across America. Yesterday there were, and I know this morning, large movements in Spain and Ireland, many of the countries that have been very, very hard hit by trickle-down austerity measures imposed upon them by the banksters at the EU. Any updates on what's happening internationally on this May Day?
Well, I was at the UN today, but other than that amazing report that you referred to the other day in your blog, or your piece that we also ran on Talk Radio News, The People and the Planet, there wasn't much noise at all, even at the noon briefing today. I mean, people just didn't even deal with it. However, The People and the Planet was sort of top of the hit parade, and you really outlined sort of the broad brush of it. But today, Sir Sulston, who is a Nobel laureate and chair of the Institute for Science, Ethics, and Innovation, really talked about the fact that he said, we're not talking about money being used. That isn't the issue. It's resources, basically. And that we have got to cut down, essentially, on our consumption, on our resources, if we're going to really change it and make it a fair world for all of us.
Yeah, we humans are, and fair relative to our biosphere, which we're fouling our own nest. We're consuming more than half of all the fresh water on Earth right now, leaving every other living thing to compete for what's left. And that's with, 7/8 of us living on less than $2 or $3 a day.
A billion people, the nice word is food insecurity.
Yeah.
The folks from The People and the Planet, which you referred to in your post the other day, really it has to do with the fact that there's a billion people who don't get enough food on a daily basis. And you certainly saw that in South Sudan, and I see it in South Sudan still.
Yeah, I've seen it. I saw it in Uganda as well. Well, you can see that in Mississippi, too.
Right.
Right now, there's. I think the number is 20.
Unless you get the Heritage Report, who says, Americans. This was several years ago, so I have to give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they've changed it, but they literally issued a report saying, Americans were obese, so they were clearly getting enough food. I was like, what?
Right. People don't realize obesity typically is a form of malnutrition. It's eating the wrong things. It's eating, or it can be caused by.
But
some 10, 20, 30, no, it's my recollection of the last number that was published was 24,000 children every night in America go to bed hungry, which, shouldn't happen in the richest nation in the world.
That is the understatement of the century.
And millions of children experience this at least once, throughout their lifetimes. Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Check it out. Coming up next, Jackson Browne and David Graeber.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and it is May Day. It is Occupy the Earth Day. May Day has an extraordinary tradition behind it. It originally started out, never eat a salad during the break. It gets caught in your throat. The May Day originally started out back around the time of the Agricultural Revolution, which was roughly 10,000 years ago. And, it was the spring in the Northern Hemisphere, and particularly out of Northern Europe. And it was a time when people would pray to the gods of fertility to make the crops grow well. And so they would eat things that had to do with fertility, like eggs, and they would sacrifice really fertile animals, animals that reproduce like crazy, like rabbits, and you know, cut their necks and spread their blood around on the fields as a way of making sure that there would be a good harvest. And then the, you know, what came out of this, this later got, you know, integrated in with as civilizations came along and gods and goddesses. And there was this goddess Ichthar, who was the goddess of fertility. And then that got co-opted by Christianity and it got called the, you know, Ichthar became Easter. And but it's all, you know, it used to be this time of new birth, of reawakening, of coming back from the winter. And that's really kind of what's going on. That's kind of what it is. And what we're seeing in the Occupy movement, I think, is a rebirth, a reawakening. And now May Day officially, the more contemporary history of it, as it's associated with the labor movement, with all that sort of thing, you know, goes back to 1886. In April of 1886, tens of thousands of workers had organized and were calling for a general strike. The epicenter of this was Chicago, interestingly enough. And on May 1st, May Day, 80,000 people showed up to strike, which brought Chicago to its knees. I mean, it just shut down the city. And on May 3rd, the Chicago police fired into a crowd of striking workers at the McCormick Reaper Works factory, killing four people, the martyrs of the Haymarket Square. The next day, there was another peaceful demonstration, and this time somebody threw a bomb and it killed a police officer. And that really set back the whole labor movement in the United States. This was 1886, and it really was almost a generation before it really got rebooted in the United States during Teddy Roosevelt's presidency in the 1900s, but the early 19-aughts, and then, you know, took fire in the 1930s with the Great Flint sit-down strike and whatnot. But there was a lot of stuff in between there, too. But what was interesting was that in 1889, 3 years after this, this had gone international. The story of Haymarket Square had gone international. And in Paris, France, an organization was created that the International Workers of the World, and they created what's called the International Workers' Day, and 80 nations now celebrate today, May Day, as an International Workers' Day, which is just a really, really great thing. So, Brian in Westmont, Illinois. Hey, Brian, thanks for listening. What's up?
Oh, hi. Calling just a couple of things. I want to say, first off, I think you do some really good work.
Thank you.
And thank you for this. But you were talking a bit about violence. And
yes,
I don't think it's always so simple. Is it just violence is always bad? It's always not good. I'm not saying I've been involved in some various things and some of the Occupy things.
Mm-hmm.
I think that a lot of people could say a lot better than I could. You could read some things by Gore Vidal. There is a book called How Nonviolence Protects the State that people could look that up, called by Peter Gelderlos, I think is his name.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, you can look at some historical events that, like Ireland, Eastern Europe in 1989, Nelson Mandela, the ANC in South Africa, and Israel as well, people like Menachem Begin. A lot of these people used violence.
Initially, yeah. I don't disagree with you that history is accurate. Let me present the flip side of this. And one of the books that I have read recently that really enlightened me is by David Swanson, who's a very, very activist fellow here in Washington, D.C. He's very involved in Occupy D.C. And it's called War is a Lie. And David points out in his book that the American Revolution didn't need to happen. That if we had, it didn't need to be a bloody war, that the Civil War didn't need to happen, that all of these, you know, wars, that these violent acts that we look at with reverence, I'm not even talking about the ones that we don't like Vietnam, or, you know, whatever, that these violent acts were unnecessary because the winds of change were blowing in any case and would have brought about the kind of change eventually without violence. And he makes a very, very strong case for this. And I really strongly recommend, if you believe that violence advances the cause of movements, that you read David Swanson's book, War is a Lie.
I'm not against that. I'm not saying it's the only way. It's different.
Oh, I get it.
Look at World War II. I don't think we had another choice.
We have a lot of people in America.
You know what Gandhi's advice to Churchill was?
Yeah, he was pacifist about Hitler. I know Gandhi. I've read
him. Yeah, Gandhi told Hitler told Churchill to just give in to Hitler. Now, here's how David Swanson plays it out in his book War is a Lie. He says, had Churchill given in to Hitler, had Hitler extended himself across Europe as he intended to do, had he taken successfully Russia, he would have been so thinned out and so wiped out, and the people would have risen up within a generation. And, you know, in perhaps by violence, probably not. The Third Reich would have collapsed the same way the Roman Empire did. And yes. You know, horror stories don't stand. Pol Pot's, you know, group is no longer running Cambodia. And they didn't need us to come to the rescue. And
we fought the Taliban. I mean, I saw Bill Clinton and many people who are, quote, pacifists before endorse war against the
I don't think Bill Clinton is a pacifist. And that's, this is not a knock on Bill Clinton or Barack Obama for that matter, or any of, you know, the American presidents. I mean, Jimmy Carter is one of the few not to have a war on his watch. But, Bill Clinton's not a pacifist. He intervened in Kosovo.
Well, he was a draft resister. You know, he didn't go to Vietnam.
He was he was opposed to the Vietnam War. That's a very different thing from being a pacifist. Now, there were some people who were opposed to the Vietnam War because they were pacifists. Bill Clinton was opposed to the Vietnam War because he thought it was the wrong war to have. It was an illegal war. I agree with him on that. I was opposed to the Vietnam War for the same reason. I probably, you know, when I read David's book and Louise and I had dinner with him and had a conversation about this, and I've heard him give a couple of talks on over at Busboys and Poets here in Washington, D.C. on it. And it's, you know, I've been rolling this thing around in my head for months now since the first time, you know, I read David's book and talked with him. And up until that time, I mean, for my whole entire life, I have been one of the very first people to say I would have been there at the very beginning of World War II. Or you could even make the case that Roosevelt, as soon as he knew what was being done to the Jews, which was long before we entered the war, should have just gone in and taken out Hitler. You know, just good to take out the command. You know, bomb the eagle's nest. I mean, these bizarre rules of war that countries follow, that you don't go after the leader of the other country. You go after the armies, you know, armies against armies and stuff, that go back to the days when kings fought wars amongst themselves, multi-generationally, just to keep the people impoverished, basically, keep the people down, and to keep the people building the castle bigger and bigger and bigger so that it would be a place of refuge. You know, it's just the whole history of war is bizarre. And it's... Actually, we're out of time. So, Brian, it's a thought-provoking conversation, and I appreciate your calling and thinking about it. I'm not dismissing your point of view.
Thank you.
I honor it. I don't know any absolutes here. I do know, I can tell you, though, I do know from personal experience in the 60s, the Weather Underground hurt SDS. I can tell you that, or at least it did at MSU. Brian, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, I still am in touch with some old friends from the Weather Underground from those days who would disagree with me. So what can you do?
The revolution will not be televised, but it's alive and kicking online. Forget Fox and the major networks. They're way behind the times. It's Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Videos, blogs, and texts. From cell phones, webcams, laptops. And who knows what's coming next. The revolution is on its way.
Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, and Paul in Wheeling, West Virginia, listening on Sirius XM. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom, listen, I'm calling because you have been preaching to me, I take it, for years about getting involved.
Yes, sir.
I'm 61 years old, and I retired, and I happened to, by accident, wander into a Democratic fundraiser, and I met a candidate who is truly progressive, who believes in taking care of Social Security and keeping the hospitalization as single payer.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to give you an idea. Her name is Sue Thorne.
Okay.
Now she, I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but the oil companies have infiltrated the northern panhandles of West Virginia now. We have Exxon,
Yeah, they're all looking for places they can go fracking.
Right, right. And what we have is the last I heard, there was a piece in the paper where David McKinley has $1.5 million in his war chest.
Who's he?
And Sue, he is the incumbent Republican congressman.
I see. Okay.
And Sue has 54,000.
Sue Thorne is the progressive Democrat who's running against him.
Correct.
So and people can Google Sue Thorne and check out her website and find out what her positions are. Yeah. And if they want to support her, be, you know, toss some money her way or volunteer, pitch in or help out or whatever. But there's a your congressional district in West Virginia, and Wheeling, West Virginia is at play.
I'm not sure that. I'm not sure that. But I've never participated at all, and I followed your lead, and I said, you know what, it's time to jump in and do something, because all wars are won by one battle at a time.
You betcha.
And I thought, you know, I really feel good about her. I've never felt this good about a candidate in my life. I sat down and talked to her a couple times, and I just wanted to let the people in West Virginia know that we have a progressive Democrat who feels that the people are first. She's taking no corporate money of any kind. She's running strictly a grassroots campaign.
That's great. So check out Sue Thorne. You can Google her website. And, Paul, tell her to get in contact with Sean Taylor, our producer, our executive producer, because we do every week we do one of these Taking Your Country Back segments where we put on progressive Democrats or progressives who are running for office. They need not even be Democrats. Bernie Sanders is an independent.
I have a hard time getting through on your – I try to send you emails to send this to you. If I gave you her phone number
– No. Paul, I'm going to put you on hold, and you can talk with our Paul, and he'll get the information from you. So I'm putting you on hold, and Paul can talk to Paul, and we'll take care of it. Melissa in Marshall, North Carolina. Hey, Melissa, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just want to let you know that because of a story earlier about the American Red Cross.
Right. We had the international VP of the Teamsters on. They're leading a strike action against the Red Cross. Yes.
Exactly. And, you know, my husband and I had not any awareness of that, but we called our local Red Cross where we donate blood.
Mm-hmm.
And we said we are putting our donations on hold until such time as the labor disputes are settled and the workers are back to work.
Wow. That's huge. That is. I mean, that's when strikes start becoming effective, is when it's not just the strikers, but when other people jump in and participate. Good on you, Melissa. Thank you very much for doing that and for sharing that with our listeners.
It's my pleasure. I also want a shout out in North Carolina. Vote against Amendment 1.
What is Amendment 1?
The North Carolina legislature is taking – it's already illegal in North Carolina for gays to marry.
Uh-huh.
They're taking it to a whole new degree with Amendment 1. And without getting into the whole thing, it's going to hurt straight couples. It's going to hurt kids. It's going to hurt as far as insurance. It's unbelievably – it's like sticking the knife in and twisting it.
Yeah, okay.
So –
Melissa, so vote no on Amendment 1 if you're living in North Carolina. Got it.
Thanks.
Melissa, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it. Denver in Seattle, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Denver, what's up?
Hey, I was listening to you and I just had some questions and some information about the origins of May Day.
Sure.
And maybe that we could exchange some information because I practice Wicca. And some of the things that I've been reading about and some of the things that you've been talking about coincide, but I do have questions here. Maybe we could
go
talk
for
about
it.
These. Let's see here. May would be Beltane.
Yeah, Beltane used to be – well, Beltane still is. I have friends who are celebrating Beltane right now. Yeah.
There's a lot of three spring fertility festivals, the first being Candlemas.
That's right.
Yeah,
Beltane and May Day and the May Day pole, Beltane, yeah, it's all the same stuff.
Oh, wow.
Okay. All righty. thanks a lot for the call, Denver. Dell in Skomania City? Skomania City, Washington. Hey, Dell, what's up?
No, Skomania County.
Oh, County, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're the south end of the county that has Mount St. Helens.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, I called in about a run-up on the discussion you had with the lady a little earlier about immigrants.
Yeah.
And this is a pet peeve of mine all the time. There is nobody that is natural to the United States. All our people came from someplace else.
Yeah.
The Indians people walked in. The rest of us, our people were a little later, Johnny-come-latelys, and they got a little easier trip in by boat or plane or however they got here.
Sure.
But it has been the immigrants, and you touched on this comment, it has been the immigrants that made this country strong.
Yes.
And rather than objecting to people coming here from another country, they should be welcome.
I absolutely agree. And this is why we need good, comprehensive, common sense, rational reform of our immigration policies and laws. Del, thank you very much for a very, very cogent comment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Singer-songwriter Jackson Brown coming up after the break. Stick around. 27 minutes past the hour. Back at the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across North America, on Pacifica stations in America, Europe, and Africa, on Armed American Forces Radio on every military base in the world, and simulcast as TV on both Dish Network and DirecTV nationwide in 55 million homes. Jackson Brown on the line with us. MusicForOccupy.org is the website. And Jackson Brown, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Nice to be here.
I have to tell you, you are one of a very small handful of people who have given me hours and hours and hours of not only pleasure but inspiration. Your writing is as brilliant as your performance. I don't often gush at guests. I got to tell you.
No, I appreciate it.
It's an honor to speak to you. This new album, let me just give the setup for this and then let me throw it to you. Occupy, this album, a compilation of music by, for, and inspired by the Occupy Wall Street movement. All the proceeds go directly to the Occupy Wall Street movement. This includes, well, actually, and there's going to be, for our listeners on WWRL in New York City or who are listening on Sirius or XM or whatever in the Manhattan, in the New York area, on May 8th, there'll be a release party for the album at the winery, and the City
right.
Winery, and you can get information about that at citywinery.com. But give us a take on the album, unless you don't have the list of performers in front of you. I do, and I can go through it, but let me toss it to you, Jackson Brown.
We both can. Basically, this is an album that came out of the Occupy, the occupation of Zuccotti Park, and I actually met the guy that put this album together when I was there playing in December, right after they sort of closed the occupation down but continued to have a presence there. So there's a hard copy of the album, which has got like a 4 CD copy, and then there's a downloaded. The rest of them are on download. So I think there are 99 artists in all that have given songs to this record and inspired by the movement or written for it especially.
It's remarkable. Musicforoccupy.org is where you can get the information, and this includes never-before-released tracks from Annie DeFranco, Uncle, David Armin, Joan Baez, Tom Chapin, Willie Nelson, Rain Phoenix, Patti Smith, Annie Flagg, Girls Against Boys, Garland Jeffries, New Party Systems, the Mammals featuring Pete Seeger, David Crosby, and Graham Nash, Jackson Brown, the Guthrie Family. It's extraordinary.
Michael Moore.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I just was in New York the other night. Matter of fact, we're doing a fundraiser for a film that's being made about the Koch brothers. And Mike, I conscripted him to sing with me. And he sang the song that he did on this record, which is Times Are Changing. Fantastic.
It never occurred to me that Michael Moore could sing.
He can sing. He sings great.
Another talent. He's got to be one of the most talented people around. Extraordinary. So, Jackson Brown, give us your sense. What inspired your song on this album, and what's the message of your song?
Well, the song came together sort of naturally after playing this song that Little Steven wrote called "I'm a Patriot," which has become a staple in my show. And we would also, we'd always want to keep playing it because people were so pumped and so energized after hearing I'm a Patriot. And we would, we just keep the song going and we just began jamming and I began sort of singing stuff out. I started making up verses to go to a similar groove. I mean, it was the same beat, but we just sort of converted into an ongoing song. And I mean, during the 2008 election, we used to go into It's Your Thing, Do What You Want to Do. I can't tell you who to barack it to, but basically, we were not really sort of, you know, jumping for Obama so much as just telling people, you got to do what you want to do, but, you know, yeah. What I'm going to do. And so it sort of turned into a song which I tried to sort of address. I mean, I was sort of faced with a choice. I mean, do you start singing song verses about the issues, in which case it could be a really long song. If you started writing songs and verses about single-use plastic or about you know, genetically modified food, or just about oil in general, about war, about health issues, about people's issues. You know, I mean, it's hard to condense them, but Occupy happened, and it was easier to talk about. It was actually easy to refer to all those things by referring to Occupy. So that's how the song came to be. And I had written the first part, the first verse, about a year before. And was singing that at the end of another song, but then I finished the last verse as we got ready to sing at Zuccotti Park.
When we were back in the years when George Bush was president and was, you know, and everybody was beating the drums for war, and we were pushing back very hard against that on this program, and after the war, you had come out around that time, as I recall, with Lives in the Balance, one of the. I'm not sure what year it came out, but...
Well, actually, that song goes back to the 80s. It actually was way before Bush, because that song initially was about our involvement in Central America, but it could have been about any number of places where the United States has conducted covert war. So actually, I started singing it again around that same time, around the time of the Iraq War.
We started.
One of my sons said, "Look, you can start singing this song again."
Yeah, he was right. I mean, we use it as a bumper from time to time. It was such a powerful statement. The power of music. You know, for years, the brain researchers have discovered that we process music principally in the right part of our brains, the right parietal region, when we process language in the left parietal regions, you know, Wernicke's and Broca's regions. And what music does, because it has words and music together, is it kind of creates this brain coherence.
Yeah.
Does music create a zen state for you? Does it take you someplace that words don't?
Music can literally change the world. And by that I mean that it does it. Every time you listen to music, you're changing your consciousness and you're changing the world. Just try it. I mean, to have no music on and then put something on, you could be in a crowded place and suddenly you're listening to Aretha Franklin and it's a different, completely different world.
Yeah.
But it does change everything. And it's good for carrying ideas and thoughts and especially emotions. But it's not necessarily good for carrying a lot of detailed information on it. On a particular subject, but unless the people listening already know a great deal, and then it's a really amazing way of connecting those thoughts with emotion and with feeling and with action, really.
Right, which is what you've done so brilliantly with so many of your pieces of music. The new album
go ahead. Thanks, that's a very high compliment. In truth, you know, like I've been trying to slip a few of these songs into sets about relationships and about love and about in general for years. So it's really great to have an audience that's you know, when an audience is gathered to talk about specific issues, these songs actually they're made for that, especially.
Yeah, and music changes the world. Music is and you're doing it. Musicforoccupy.org is the website. The album is it called Occupy This Album?
I think it's called Occupy This Album. Yeah, and I mean there are people here who listen to some of the names. I only know about half of those, but then there's a whole other download where you get like there are 99 people on this record. So I'm looking forward to listening to them all and to finding out where all these people weigh in and what kinds of contributions they're all making.
And let's emphasize one more time, all the proceeds from this go directly to the Occupy Wall Street movement.
Yeah.
And this is Yoko Ono is part of this. Kip Malone,
yeah,
Amanda Palmer. It just
extraordinary. Yola Tango.
Yeah, there you go.
Yola Tango.
So, Jackson Brown, what's next for you?
I'm just trying to write some songs I like. Actually, I've got a couple of songs, like, just on the subject we were just on. I got songs that have such freighted language. I'm thinking they probably would do better as a narration, you know, for a film. So I'm actually making a couple. I'm going to try to get films made about the two songs that I've written most recently, one of which is about single-use plastic and the ocean, the fate of the ocean, which hangs in the balance. And I know a lot of people that have been making films about the ocean and about the problem with plastic and about conservation and protecting our oceans. And so that actually might turn out to be like the song I wrote would probably be better listened to along with the imagery that would go with it. And then there's another song I wrote about Haiti that turned into a song about our inability to deal with disasters and how unprepared our society is to handle, you know. I mean, and of course, the most ongoing disaster of, you know, humanity is that of poverty and inability to deal with disease. So, I mean, that's a song also that would go well with. I mean, some of the people that have been to Haiti want to try to make a film with that. So that's what I'm doing. I'm not in a huge hurry to try to make an album because I think it would be quicker just to go to try to make these songs and get them seen by people as opposed to, with the internet, you can, you know, millions of people can see these things if it's a good new song, if it's a well-made film that, you know, you can get a lot of people to see it before they'll see it if you just could, like, try to release on an album and put it out in the commercial.
You know, Leo DiCaprio did a movie documentary called The 11th Hour. Maybe he's up for something like that. Earl Katz just helped put together a movie that I narrated called Heist, which is out right now in theaters.
Oh, really?
It's about the banksters, you know, taking us down in 2008. I wish you the very best on that. And if there's ever anything that we can do to help, please let me know.
Thank you, Jackson
Brown. Of course, your website, I believe, is jacksonbrown.com, right?
That's right.
Okay,
that's
but music for Occupy.org.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jackson.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Check that out, musicforoccupy.org. All proceeds go to the Occupy Wall Street movement. Back with more Occupation of the Media right after this.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the camp. And there is blood on the wire.
Oh, amazing. One of my favorite songs of all times. Axel Caballero is with us. He is the founder and producer of Cuéntame. Axel, my apologies for my terrible Spanish pronunciation.
Oh, no problem. It was very good this time. It's just the accent on the Cuéntame.
Cuéntame. Thank you. I know the first time I had you on TV, I just mangled both your name and Cuéntame. And I hope I haven't. If I've mangled your name, please correct me.
No, it was perfect.
Okay. You guys are well, first of all, tell our viewers and listeners about Cuéntame.
Well, Cuéntame, we are a community and a project within the larger scope of Brave New Foundation, and we do a lot of documentary series and campaigns to support not only a wide variety of issues within the Latino community, but also, as was the case today, worker rights issues, family issues, or Latino family issues as it relates to employment, and as well as in general, just Latino arts, Latino students, for example, and a wide variety through video and in partnership with other organizations to really create an impact. It translates and means Cuéntame, it means count me in or tell me your story. And so that's what we do. We tell stories to get people counted.
Okay. And the website, by the way, I should have mentioned this when you first came on, is MyCuéntame, which is spelled CuéntameCuéntame.com. MyCuéntame.com. And Axel, tell me about the May Day March in support of the LA trash workers.
Oh, it was fantastic. We there was a coalition of organizations, Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy, the LA County Federation, the Teamsters, along with Cuéntame, and together we were supporting, particularly outside of American Reclamation Center, Recycling Center, workers there who have been complaining time and again for a long time now on abuses, particularly abuses as it relates to their treatment, lack of safety, lack of security. When they stand up for their rights, they get terminated. And it's become a really, really a big problematic in the area, a big problem. So that's where we're there. Dolores Huerta spoke out. We had a band out international, Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine, who spoke out and performed. We had Marilena Durazo from the LA County Fed and Labor Leader also speak out. There were hundreds and hundreds of people. I think, some estimates, were between 700 or 800 folks. And it was really an amazing event. We screened a video that Cuéntame produced in partnership with these organizations to really support the rights of these workers, which are being abused consistently. And whenever they try to speak out, which is a very concerning fact, is that they're getting reprimanded severely.
And my guess is this is not a situation unique to Los Angeles.
No, definitely not. This is widespread. This is actually symbolic to something happening widespread, not only in the state of California, but across the country. As more and more these private recycling facilities have been receiving contracts from cities like American Reclamation, who is receiving a contract from El Monte City, these abuses are ignored because the amount of money that is being dealt with is enormous. And these contracts obviously benefit the pockets of a few, while many workers barely make minimum wage. They are under severe conditions. In fact, in this particular case, two workers, there were 16 and 17, they died in one of the facilities. They died because of lack of proper safety. And nobody compensated. Nobody talked about it. They just hush-hushed the situation. And so that's what we're claiming. That's what we're going against, an enormous amount of greed by the part of these corporations. And then the city, and pushing the cities to really take a look twice, to look twice at the contracts that they're about to dish out.
Yeah, this is the dark side of both recycling and privatization, of functions that, you know, particularly when cities are supposed to be responsible for dealing with the trash, and they're contracting it out to private corporations, just privatization in general, is it not?
Yes, and what it causes, it creates a vacuum. It creates a vacuum where there's barely any regulation because there is a faith put into these corporations that they're going to act on behalf of the constituents and on behalf of the citizens and on behalf of the city, for that matter, because they have signed a contract. But what ends up happening is that they operate under their own rules and they operate under their own labor laws. They create their own regulations to a certain extent. They subcontract and they blame the subcontractors for some of the abuses that are happening, and they relinquish all responsibility. And so that is what we need to face when we have a local community or a local city or a city council facing the situation of privatizing one of the services. We really have to stand up and ask the right questions and demand that other alternatives are looked at, or that at the minimum that, you know, worker rights are at the negotiating table.
Yeah, absolutely. Axel Caballero, Cuéntame.
Perfect.
Cuéntame, the website. MyCuéntame, MyCuéntame.com, for the great work that you're doing. Congratulations on a successful action today.
So much, and I really do encourage your listeners to email citycouncil@elmonteca.gov, and that is ELMONTCA.gov, and tell them to protect worker rights and say no to American Reclamation.
You got it, Axel. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Great speaking with you. Coming up tomorrow, big news on the Walker recall. Malfeasance and his campaign finance reports, the $260,000. Plus, President Obama today in Afghanistan says, yeah, we're going to keep the troops there for a while. We'll be talking about that. Plus, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, could he be the next to go? We'll be talking with Tony Trupiano. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.